Central Indiana. It's the Insurgent Radio Network with Tom Hester, Terrible Tommy, broadcasting live from the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, right next to the Terrible Tommy Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to drink, sometimes eat. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. You can address your letters and mail to Tom Hester, the Insurgent, or just old plain box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
A long, long time ago, we used to get our food homegrown, and toothpaste used to make you smile. It used to be you'd shop with ease, never eating antifreeze. You planned to keep on living by a while. But now our goods are all delivered from somewhere on the Yangtze River. No one knows the source there, so you might find some horsehair. But if corporations make a buck, they don't give up flying. Peking duck. And with this system we get stuck today, it makes you sigh. Now when you apply an American pie, your grandma didn't think it was made in Shanghai, where they engineered the apple to be juicy, not dry. But the crust is made of cardboard and lime. Don't feed it to your dog, he might die. Now, did you eat a tasty cake, and did it make your stomach ache? I could have said I told you so. And the reason you are looking fun is some guy surprised in Szechuan. So you've just been into Little Debbie's home. Bought from Fisher Price have toxins deemed unsafe for mice, and Elmo tends to wheeze. I'll be glad when he's in me, but I know my problems ain't so far when I see my cheap new DVR. I'll even brush my teeth with tar, and you will see that I'll buy a pie from some young guy. I'd rather spend it and get steady, but the price is too high.
Ain't that the by God truth? Hey, here's Terrible Tommy here in the bunker. Snowing like a son of a gun outside today. Started out in the middle of the night and it's piling up, man. I'm not going to try to go out and go anywhere. I'm just going to sit here by the fire and do this radio show. Yeah, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, but resist.com is the big website. And the She-Wolf is putting it back together, reconstructing it, and it's going to be great. A lot of it's up there already, so go on up there and check it out, resist.com. And don't forget to send a donation once in a while, and we'll make sure it gets to the right place. That's right. Well, I see old Donnie Trump. he's got things moving again. He's got them rattled again. This is beautiful. It's beautiful. Worse is better. And this is the best way to get rid of the Republican Party, which is doing white working class people no good at all. You know it. I know it. They're helping everybody but the white working class. And as far as Obama's concerned, he has piled up more profits for the big shots, the 1%, than anybody before him, I think. Whatever happened to that, I'm going to help the Negroes. I think the Negroes better check it out, because Obama's made billions, billions. And the insurance companies, they've cleaned up on Obamacare. They really cleaned up. So somebody's getting screwed, and I think it's all of us, man. Yeah. But you can't tell me there's any good reason not to get rid of the Republican Party. All they can think about is starting going into wars and occupying countries and spending trillions on so-called defense, which is nothing but war material, and bailing out the big banks and the big corporations and everything else. Since when is the Republican Party the party of the white working class? So they're not. So let's get rid of the goddamn thing. And Trump's going to help us. I think he is. They may end up with a new party. I don't know. Or I prefer no parties at all, just like George Washington. Right. And another thing, let's get rid of that Interstate Commerce Act. Boy, there's nothing screwing up the states and the state sovereignty like the Interstate Commerce Act. A lot of people don't talk about that, but you should be talking about it. Because they can screw with you in many, many, many different ways with that interstate commerce. I see some sheriff up there in Oregon's got his ass in trouble because he evidently conferred probably nicely with the militia people. Yeah, and now the feds are after his ass. FBI's after his ass. So there you go. When they gonna learn, man? You can't play around with those people. And you can't negotiate with them. You just have to wait till the right time comes. Just remember that French Revolution, they didn't take up lists of names and so forth to support their effort. They didn't put out all kinds of petitions. Please, please, Mr. King, do us right. Yeah, we deserve to be treated decent. No, they just chopped heads off like ISIS. I don't know. I haven't seen any more head chops off from ISIS. Maybe they're doing it and the press has just got bored with talking about it. I don't know. Well, I see a young daughter of an Idaho militia member was shot and wounded on Sunday after a meeting of the 111% Idaho militia. The 12-year-old girl was not identified, but was taken to the hospital by helicopter for treatment after the shooting at Rupert Gun Range. The girl's mother said the girl was stable condition as of Monday morning, and that the shooting is under investigation. I don't think there's much to investigate. Some dumbass that don't know how to handle his weapon got let it get away from him and shot the poor kid in the gut. You're going to have to pardon me, but I'm of the opinion there are a lot of people around that shouldn't have guns. Because they're always shooting each other. These hunters shooting each other. Fathers shooting their kids accidentally and so forth. And sometimes on purpose. Well, I see a New York woman who served 10 years in prison after a cop falsified a confession is finally exonerated. Isn't that nice? Now, isn't this a bit racist from Ben Carson, the super-duper genius black guy who's running for president? He says all skin folk aren't kinfolk. Sounds a little racist to me. Of course, it don't bother me. But things like that bother a lot of other people. Well, I see that Obama wants to close Guantanamo, the prison camp. Well, I agree with him about that. It's the Republicans want to keep it going and keep spending more and more and more money on it. They should return those people back to the countries where they came from. Just like it's time to return Sirhan Sirhan back to his country, too. He's been in there 50 years. That's long enough. You know, Germans were kept here in prison camps after the war, and Japanese and Italians weren't kept in the prison camp one-tenth of the time that these people in Guantanamo have been kept. Check in on Populous Hightower and see what he's got to say today about Big Pharma.
Big news, people, especially for those of you upset by the skyrocketing prices of the essential prescription medicines you take. including thousands of patients who were hit last year with a 5,000% increase in one life-saving drug. Determined to do something about those despised price hikes, drug makers themselves have reached into their corporate toolbox for the two most effective means they have to fix their price problem. Of course, putting more corporate cash into research to produce new medicines would be one of those tools, and a renewed commitment to honest competition would be the other, right? Right. But Big Pharma gave up years ago on doing right, turning to two other corporate tools that have reliably generated a gusher of profits for them: advertising and lobbying. So here they come, wielding bigger-than-ever ad and lobbying budgets to deal with that pesky matter of public anger at drug company price gouging. The intent of the multimillion-dollar PR blitz and intensified offensive in Congress is not to restrain the gouging, but to improve the industry's image in hopes of restraining lawmakers from taking steps to rein in prescription costs. Of course, their ads dishonestly fail to mention this selfish intent, instead pitching drug makers as selfless saviors of humanity. They feature soft scenes of drug researchers in white lab coats urgently trying to find new cures, scripted testimonials from people posed as patients who've been saved by Big Pharma, and of course, scenes of drug makers altruistically aiding poor people. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, you see, the industry is spending millions on this corporate medicine show not to protect its notorious profiteering, but to protect you from public officials who might try to stop them from overcharging you.
Well, thank you, Jim Hightower. That was pretty good. Go after those drug pushers. They're unbelievable. And that's all you get on television now is advertisements for drugs. And most of them don't work or will kill you.
Turned out to protest the FBI's fight against Apple, but many more from the Black Lives Matter movement turned out for a demonstration of their own. There were the familiar calls for Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez to step down. Then things got heated when the protesters sat on the sidewalk in front of the store, some of them refusing to clear a path for pedestrians. There was pushing and shoving, and things got a bit scary.
The whole damn system! Filthy ass hell!
At least one protester was taken into custody, an American flag was set on fire, and then quietly the protesters moved on. Meanwhile, one of the leaders of the Apple protest said they were frustrated at getting drowned out, but they recognize everyone's right to make their voice heard. Terry Keschner, News Radio on 105.9 FM.
Yeah, that was Chicago this morning. Little demonstration going on there by Black Lives Matter. You wouldn't think so if you read how many of them are killing each other in the ghetto. Well, if you're in Chicago today or in Indiana, especially northern Indiana, you better head for a hole, man.
In parts of the Chicagoland area.
Yeah, travel could really be tricky for most of the day, so much so that there's actually a ban on certain trucks on the toll road right now. Let's hand things over to CBS 2's Mike Puccinelli, who's live in the Mobile Weather Lab in Portage. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, good morning to you. Shakespeare once said, "Something wicked this way comes." I think those words definitely apropos today, because we're definitely starting to feel it right now. I want to turn your attention to the flag. You can see it is really being whipped by these winds right here alongside the Indiana Toll Road. You alluded to it a second ago. As we pan to the right, you can see the toll road right over there. You can see some of the trucks that have pulled over, guys getting some rest right now in those trucks, undoubtedly. And many of them will have to get on the road soon, especially the ones that are in doubles, triples, and in steel haulers and in oversized vehicles, because those vehicles are banned from the toll road, all 156 miles of it, stretching from the highway all the way to the Ohio Turnpike, beginning at noon Eastern time today and lasting until noon Eastern time tomorrow.
So that's the way it's going back here in the Midwest. It's getting wild. You hear the latest? The niggers are eating the Chicago jails. Yeah, eating the Chicago jails.
Now a truly bizarre story costing taxpayers millions of dollars. Cook County inmates literally eating the jail, swallowing small pieces of metal and ending up in the hospital. In this original report, CBS 2 investigator Dave Savini has the x-rays to prove it.
Take a good look at these x-rays, obtained by the two investigators. Ingested pieces of metal.
metal from the Cook County Jail.
Metal swallowers. Okay. What kind of, who would ever think we'd be talking about this?
Sheriff Tom Dart was concerned about stabbing fights and fires when he took office, not this new problem that's costing taxpayers millions.
On my list of things to do was not like, okay, now how do you get around people who are swallowing the jail?
Metal-swallowing inmate Lamont Cathy alone has cost county taxpayers more than $1 million, according to reports.
So metal swallowers become a big problem financially.
Oh, my God. The amount of money we have spent both in the hospital area, but then with staff having to watch these folks, I couldn't even calculate it. I know it's in the millions, so.
So he swallowed screws and nails
and pieces of whatever fall off the benches, paint. He don't care.
Lamont Cathy has had 19 or 20 metal-related surgeries, says his mother, Lorene Barber.
The doctor was like, he gonna make it if he just stopped eating.
She says her son needs psychological help, and he's not the only one swallowing metal. Jail records include multiple inmates that reported swallowing screws or unidentified metal, others swallowing buttons. Two reported swallowing the contents of ice packs. One inmate, bleeding from the mouth, said he swallowed a pin, while another put small parts of his wheelchair in his mouth.
I'm at a loss. I don't know how to prevent some of this stuff anymore.
That's because inmates with no access to metal will find something to consume when they're transported to court or other parts of the jail.
They're manipulating. They're attempting to get out of this place.
Inmates like Cathy often get taken to outside hospitals, including Stroger, for x-rays and surgery and other treatment, which requires two guards to be at the hospital at all times, another for transport.
Which is a very, very expensive proposition.
Overall, taxpayers spend about $77 million a year treating Cook County jail inmates. Exactly how much on metal eaters is not known, but it's a lot.
You can't budget for it because you never know when someone's going to eat your jail. So that's all overtime.
Sheriff Dart says he has moved metal eaters to cells with concrete beds and no access to tables or chairs that have metal. Those inmates also are transported differently if they still find things to swallow. Jail reports show inmates doing this after getting bad news from home or wanting medical or psychological attention or just wanting time out of jail. And Erica and Rob, Dart doesn't know what to do about this. He says he's tried everything.
It's really incredible the lengths that people will go to. It's got to be difficult to tackle a situation like this.
And it comes down to the need for some mental health issues.
Which has always been one of the common refrains from the sheriff. And I would think that once they figure out the metal thing, it'll probably be something else then.
Let's hope so. It's costing us a lot of money.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, there you go. Niggers are killing each other on the outside and eating the jail on the inside, baby. What are you going to do? Here's another story out of Chicago. A white, blonde-haired, nice-looking white cop, female, covered for a stone-cold black nigger with many felonies on his record. Listen to this.
Chicago's interim police superintendent is now reacting to a story that two investigator Pam Zeckman and the Better Government Association broke last night. Why is a cop still on the job after she admitted lying under oath in a criminal case? CBS 2 investigator Pam Zeckman reports.
This morning, we learned that acting Chicago Police Superintendent John Escalante had not even heard of the case involving Officer Allison Bogdalek until the CBS 2 BGA story.
That was a case that I was not aware of.
That's changed now.
It's definitely on the radar screen, yes.
Our story showed video evidence of Officer Bogdalek appearing to lie.
He did a photo ray. He couldn't pick him out of the picture that we gave him.
Officer Bogdalek was talking about showing a victim photos of Rance Allen Hankerson, who was charged with 29 felony counts, including attempted murder and armed robbery for a liquor store robbery. Later in court, Officer Bogdalek testified under oath that there had been no photo array. Bogdalek later admitted to lying about the photo array, and charges against Hankerson were dropped.
That officer, it's my understanding, was relieved of her police powers and has been in an administrative position pending the disciplinary case.
A case that has taken 3 years, while Bogdalek earned about $80,000 a year on desk duty. And even though her office recommended a perjury prosecution, Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez declined to prosecute Bogdalek. The state's attorney's office says that because Officer Bogdalek admitted to the lie while the case was still pending, under state law, she could not be charged with perjury. But CBS2 legal analyst Irv Miller says there were other options.
She could have been charged with official misconduct and obstructing justice. And if the proof existed, she could have easily been convicted.
Officer Bogdalik told investigators that two sergeants and a lieutenant told her to keep quiet about the lie. That was news to Escalante.
I've asked Internal Affairs to give me a better briefing.
When police officers don't get disciplined or held accountable or charged for bad behavior, they're more likely to do it again because they think they can do it with impunity.
Pam Zekman, CBS2 Investigators.
Officer Bogdalik could not be reached for comment. A police department spokesman said Escalante was briefed late today by Internal Affairs and its investigation is nearly done.
Well, isn't that interesting? A white cop is not shooting blacks in the street. She's covering for their black asses when they've committed 29 felonies. How about that? And now they didn't charge her even with perjury. Boy, now you've been misled to think that cops only shot niggers, didn't you? Well, they shoot a lot of white people. Here's an example of a young teenager.
More questions tonight about Chicago police and the use of deadly force. A Northside teen was stopped for a curfew violation. More questions tonight about Chicago police and the use of deadly force. A Northside teen was stopped for a curfew violation and ended up shot twice by a Chicago police officer. The high school student survived the shooting 2.5 years ago and in this original report tells his story to 2 investigator Dave Savini.
I don't think he had any reason to shoot me, which was exactly excessive force.
Richie Skibicki was a 16-year-old Lincoln Park High School sophomore when he was shot by a Chicago police officer. This is the aftermath.
You think you're lucky to be alive?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the bullet in my leg was 2 centimeters away from my major artery in my leg.
He says the bullet is still in his leg. He also was struck in the arm. A third shot missed him. It began with a midnight snack run at Narragansett and Montrose in 2013.
Where were you coming from?
We're coming from this gas station right here, the BP.
According to a lawsuit Skibicki filed, he was walking with friends past his curfew when police asked for his ID. He said he didn't have it, which enraged one officer, who began screaming at him.
He was like an inch away from my face.
And he says he was frightened by what the officer screamed at him.
He said, how am I supposed to identify your dead body if I find you on the street? And after yelling at me, I took off running down this alley.
And how far did you run?
Maybe 3/4 down this alley.
He then tried to climb a fence, and that's when he says bullets started to fly.
So he starts firing at you, and you don't have any kind of weapon?
No, not at all.
At the time of the incident, CPD officials said Skibicki swung this wooden board posing a threat. Skibicki says that's not true and that he never once swung or even held the board that was allegedly found near the scene.
You know, he's not going to just say he shot me for running away.
It just doesn't add up. It did not happen.
Attorney Lance Northcutt, who filed a lawsuit for Skibicki, says police fabricated the board story.
There has to be some explanation as to why you just shot a curfew violator twice. Who's unarmed?
He in part points to this evidence photo of the board. It sits in a perfectly straight line, parallel to the sidewalk, not tossed about.
You think that board was planted there?
Absolutely.
So you were only a few blocks from your house?
Yeah.
You thought you could make it?
Yeah, that's what I was aiming for.
Pretty stupid thing to do, to run?
Yeah, I admit that, but I think it was stupid of him to shoot me.
Charges against Skibicki were later vacated by a judge. 2 years after the shooting, the officer, Edward Acevedo, was cleared of any wrongdoing by IPRA, the Independent Police Review Authority. An IPRA official had no comment to questions about the positioning of that wooden board. Chicago police had no comment other than to refer us to IPRA. Rob and Erica.
So the cop in this case, since it was a white kid, doesn't get charged at all. And that board, that was a piece of lath. It was about 3 inches wide and about an inch thick. Believe me. If you're going to shoot somebody for waving around a stick at you, you deserve to go to jail. It just proves more and more these cops are ill-fitted to be cops. And in many cases, they're cowards. You know, they're afraid to go down an alley. Here's another white guy that's got screwed by the system in Chicago.
Who
Investigator Dave Savini joins us with more in this original report. Dave?
Hi. A month before Lieutenant Joe Glinowitz staged his own suicide, there were more scandals brewing up in Fox Lake, like this one. The two investigators got a tip this summer involving the police chief's alleged mishandling of numerous problems in the department. In fact, the shakeup out there didn't start until we asked for the video you're about to see.
They were trying to hide it or keep it from going public.
This is the first time Jeff Brazonka has ever seen this police video.
What do you think of that?
That's horrendous.
A Fox Lake detective was caught shoving him, grabbing his neck, pushing his face, and shoving the back of his skull into a cement wall, eventually knocking him down, causing his pants to drop.
Is that excessive force?
That's too much excessive force.
He is then moved to a different cell and into a cell door.
They put your face right into the door, huh?
That's what happened. My face got slammed into the door.
The video is from December of 2014 when he was locked up on a public intoxication charge.
The arrestee made contact with a wall and a door.
Ann Marin, the village manager, confirmed Grzanka was paid $4,000 through a settlement agreement.
You were in jail when you
signed
it?
Right, I was in jail.
But he says a lawyer representing the village pressured him to sign an agreement while behind bars in September on another unrelated charge.
And you had no lawyer there for you?
Not at the time. It was just a surprise visit.
The confidential deal came after the CBS2 investigators informed the village we knew the video existed, and after we filed a Freedom of Information request for it on August 5th.
In August, our investigation began in earnest.
Soon after, the police chief retired.
The problems in the Fox Lake Police Department are deep, cultured, and systemic.
Attorney Tony Romanucci now represents Grzanka.
I have never seen anything like that before, where a victim is forced or asked to sign a settlement agreement under duress while in jail.
He plans to file a federal lawsuit.
If it wasn't for CBS2 coming in with that FOIA request and demanding that that video be released, we would be left with an incident of misconduct that would have been deemed confidential, never would have been shown to the public.
Sources say this video was the beginning of the end for the police chief who retired and for Lieutenant Glinowitz, too, because he feared his alleged financial schemes and other past misconduct would be exposed by new leadership. He staged his own suicide just days after the chief retired.
Okay.
Now, this is common where ruling class, upper middle class whites screw working class whites. It goes on all the time. It's even more widespread in the so-called black racism and all that kind of crap. And they continually do this to other white people. The time will come when they must be punished. Now here's another story of the cop brutality in Chicago.
High-profile Chicago police video that ended in the death of an African-American man. All officers in the tasering and death of Philip Coleman had been cleared until the two investigators got the video released.
Now, as Dave Savini reports, the Independent Police Review Authority is reopening that case.
Jeffrey Coleman holds back anger at his brother's gravestone.
It's my best friend.
Philip Coleman was allegedly beaten and tortured while locked up for 12 hours in this cell. Watch as the sleeping Coleman is apparently awakened and surrounded by six armed officers. As one officer fires a taser gun, others hold him down. One officer even puts him in a chokehold. In the end, taser gun records show the gun was fired into him 16 times. And then finally, he's dragged, unconscious, down hallways.
It's gut-wrenching. It's agony. This is not a black or white thing. This is a human thing, man.
He says his brother, a University of Chicago graduate with no criminal record, was suffering a nervous breakdown. But rather than transporting him to a medical facility for a psych evaluation, he was locked up and tortured instead. 90 bruises found on his body.
What do you think about the fact that they said IPRA found no wrongdoing originally?
That shows you that this cover-up is systemic and it's decades deep in the Chicago Police Department.
Philip's father, Percy Coleman, and community supporters, including Jesse Jackson, called for a new investigation. And after nearly 3 years of waiting and the sudden release of the video, police and the mayor are conducting a new internal probe.
and then to drag him down the hall like he's a rag doll, that's just something that should not have been done, and those policemen should be fired.
He's there because of that, and the culture just needs to be changed.
CBS2 prompted the release of this video because of our legal battle for it, and IPRA opened a brand new probe. Meanwhile, the city is trying to settle this case. It claims Coleman died from a sedative he received at the hospital. The Coleman family attorney says his expert believes all the physical abuse and repeated stun gun strikes played a direct role in his death. Dave Savini, CBS2 Investigators.
Well, more on Chicago. At least six people were wounded in shootings Tuesday across Chicago. Most recently, a 37-year-old man was shot in the West Side Austin neighborhood. He was walking in the 4700 block of West Erie about 8:20 p.m. when someone shot him in the right shoulder before fleeing in a vehicle. About 6 o'clock, a teenage girl was shot in Brighton Park. The 16-year-old was walking in the 3000 block of West 37th. Well, anyhow, I mean, even on a cold night, and people are being shot all over. Of course, you know Chicago's getting to be a vast, violent wasteland. But it's amazing to me that the blacks are always crying about Black Lives Matter when most of the blacks are being killed and shot by blacks. And they don't say hardly anything about that. You don't see the demonstrations about that. Well, I see Rush Scumbaugh is crying about this is our last chance to save American culture. What the hell is American culture? There is no such thing. How about white culture? That's what this country is all about. But this mess of a culture, this diverse culture they're talking about, is garbage. Come on, you chicken shit. Here's another very interesting story. The Pope's pregnant receptionist has been found dead in her apartment on the outskirts of the city. Miriam Walu, a 34-year-old Eritrean of Eritrean origin, so she was black, was 7 months pregnant when her body was discovered. She had worked at the Pope Francis home and a priest guest house called Santa Marta for years. The Italian press reports she worked as a kind of gatekeeper for the pontiff, as well as for the bishops and the cardinals who stayed there. Very strange story. There may be more to this story come out as time goes on. See, Putin from Russia is amassing troops near the Turkish border. Well, that president of Turkey is a son of a bitch and should be dealt with. He's got a lot of people pissed off at him. Well, too bad New York City, Beijing, China is now overtaken you as the billionaire capital of the world. And a hell of a lot of those billionaires are Chinese billionaires that have gotten out of China and bought up lots of property in Manhattan. Well, I see the federal government has failed to properly monitor enrollee eligibility for Obamacare, according to a report by the Government Accountability Office. As a result, the government has made billions of dollars in Obamacare subsidy payments to individuals that may have been committing fraud. Oh, they wouldn't do that. As the report notes, the system used by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, relies on data sent by the three government agencies, the IRS, SSA, and DHS. To check eligibility for Obamacare. However, the system used by CMS is unable to verify many inconsistencies in the data. Well, the whole damn Obamacare is a scam and a fraud. It's a fraud between the insurance companies and the government to rip off the taxpayers. Now, the thing they need to do is what a lot of even politicians have been saying for quite some time. They need to allow insurance companies to bid across state lines and bid against each other. The way it is now, it's against the law for an insurance company to do that. So obviously then the insurance company jacks up the prices. So all they have to do is knock that out and things will get a lot better. But still, it's total fraud. Total government built on total fraud. Well, happy days. The flow of illegal alien children into the United States is expected to rise to a record-breaking numbers in 2016 as deportations decrease, according to leading members of the Senate's Judiciary Committee. At least 20,455 unaccompanied minors have been caught during the fiscal year of 2016 along the U.S.-Mexico border as of last month, according to the committee chairman, Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Ohio, who is not really... This is all tongue-in-cheek shit because Grassley and all these people benefit from illegal aliens. The Republican Party benefits greatly from illegal aliens. Anyhow, so who warned that if this trend continues, the number of illegal minors could eclipse a massive 2014 surge that strained the resources of the Department of Homeland Security. It was horrible. We tried our best, but we couldn't stop them, and prompted investigations into the Obama administration's handling of the issue. So what if you investigate it? If you find him guilty of anything, the Attorney General, you think you're going to arrest him? You think anybody's ever going to go to jail in Washington? While the illegal border crossing surge, the number of children actually being deported from the United States is declining. Senator said during a Tuesday hearing with senior Obama administration officials. You know, this is all just bullshit. Total bullshit. They're not stopping it. They're not deporting them hardly at all. And Obama's letting them come in. What are you going to do when the economic crash comes and there's even less jobs than there are now? Where are these people going to work? Where are they working? Because a lot of the big-time agribusiness people are dealing with people in South America anyhow and dealing less and less with people in this country. So you can see the handwriting on the wall, boys and girls.
Already this year, 110,000 migrants and refugees have arrived in Greece and Italy. Last year, the number did not reach 100,000 until the end of June. And just like last year, there's still no solution for ending the crisis. Here on Greece's border with Macedonia, frustration grows as migrants wait to cross.
This is not good. This is against human values. You're here, asylum seeker, we apply for the asylum, let us go. Why do you stop us over here?
Countries like Austria, Slovenia, and Macedonia are tightening border controls, leaving many refugees and migrants stranded. The UN Refugee Agency spokesperson, Karine de Gruul, says those restrictions have to be lifted.
They are really causing numerous hardships for the people arriving, and we call on Europe to have a unified approach based on solidarity and on international principles.
Without that unified approach, the UN says every day is likely to bring even more migrants and refugees to the border, all trying to move toward a new life in Europe.
Thanks a lot, George Bush and Cheney and all you bastards in the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. You caused this. You caused this. And you should be in The Hague being tried for war crimes. Not only against the immigration thing, but also what they're doing to Europe and the European culture. It's a crime against the European people. And it's a big crime against the Middle Eastern people. Somebody needs to pay. Well, let's look a little bit more into the strange death of Supreme Court Justice Scalia that I suspect suspected something right from the beginning, but I don't know, maybe not.
In response to a public records request made by the Washington Post, the Presidio County Sheriff's Office released an incident report from the sheriff's investigation of Scalia's death at the Cibolo Creek Ranch on February 13. The report stated that the justice's body was found in bed with a pillowcase covering his eyes. A breathing apparatus was on the table next to the bed, but it was switched off. Scalia was lying on three pillows stacked up to elevate his head. Read the incident report here. Scalia's sheets and pillows were still in the creased position from that day's room service, indicating that there was no struggle involved, the report said. The top pillowcase appeared to have shifted at some point in the night due to the weight of his pillow, causing the pillowcase to slide down and cover his eyes. The sheriff noted that the position of the pillow did not seem to have inhibited Scalia's breathing. Antonin Scalia died on Saturday, February 13. Here's a look back on his tenure, his judicial philosophy, and the legacy he leaves behind. Monica actor Natalie Jennings / The Washington Post. About 12:14 p.m., the owner of the ranch, John Poindexter, called Presidio County Sheriff Danny Dominguez to report the death but would not give him the name of the deceased person. There was then a disagreement between them about who should handle the death report. Poindexter told Dominguez that he wanted to report the death to the United States Marshals Service, but Dominguez said that it was under his jurisdiction. He then stated to me that this death was way beyond my authority and that it should go the feds, USMS, Dominguez said in the report. I then replied it doesn't matter who it is, it was still under my jurisdiction. Dominguez called the United States Marshal Ken Roberts, and they agreed to meet at the ranch, south of Marfa, Texas. The sheriff arrived about 12:35 p.m. When Dominguez arrived, he met Poindexter and Alan Foster, who is described in the report as a close friend of Scalia who had flown in with him the day before. See, Alan Foster is a prominent Washington lawyer who has argued before the Supreme Court. It was not immediately clear whether C. Alan Foster was the Scalia friend referred to in the report. A representative from his law firm said that he was traveling and that she would try to reach him. Since Scalia's death at the remote West Texas ranch, questions have been raised about how the death investigation was handled and why an autopsy wasn't performed on the 79-year-old Supreme Court justice. The Presidio County judge and the manager of the funeral home that handled Scalia's body said Scalia's family insisted on not having an autopsy done. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, Kevin Lamarck / Reuters. Scalia suffered from coronary artery disease, obesity, diabetes, and other ailments, according to a letter from his Supreme Court doctor. Presidio County District Attorney Rod Ponton told the Associated Press there was nothing suspicious about Scalia's death and cited a letter from Rear Admiral Brian P. Monahan, the attending physician for members of Congress and the Supreme Court. The February 16th letter said Scalia's many significant medical conditions led to his death, Ponton said. Monahan listed ailments including sleep apnea, degenerative joint disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and high blood pressure, the AP said. Scalia was also a smoker, the letter said. According to the Presidio County Sheriff's report, Poindexter, Foster, and the ranch manager took Dominguez to the room where Scalia died. All seemed to be in order, he wrote. Scalia was face up on the bed, covered with sheets up to his chin. Both of his hands were resting at his side. A hose for the breathing machine was found on the left side of Scalia's bed, but was not attached to him. Scalia's briefcase was found closed, on a recliner. On the kitchen counter, the sheriff found a blue stretch band exercise device. A shaving kit was on the counter in the bathroom, and his shoes were placed next to the bathtub. Scalia's suitcase was open, and the contents were neatly folded. A shirt was folded on the sofa. On the table to the right of his bed, the sheriff found a flashlight and a pitcher of water with a napkin folded over the top. On a table in the room, there was an orange cap, a set of keys, a pen, a watch, and a bottle of water. Poindexter and Foster told the sheriff that Scalia had arrived at the ranch the day before to go hunting. Poindexter has told reporters that about 35 guests were at the ranch for the weekend together. Poindexter told the sheriff that they had supper and talked for a while that evening. Scalia said that he was tired and was going to his room for the night, the sheriff wrote in his report.
I'd like to have a list of the people that were guests, 35 people guests at that thing. Interesting. Very interesting. I wonder if you found out or you heard that the mestizos turned out big time in Las Vegas, in Nevada. The Hispanics, as they call them. Now, one thing people don't realize, you've got class divisions in the Hispanic population, that the upper middle class and upper class, these Hispanics, and usually they're lighter, maybe even white, because Hispanics is means you're from the Spain. And when last time I was in Spain, there was a hell of a lot of white people there. So there's a division here. So it looks like to me probably that a large section of white Hispanics or upper-class Hispanics or upper-middle-class or middle-class Hispanics voted for Trump. And probably the mestizos, the ones on the bottom, voted for somebody else. That's just a guess. Well, I see a federal judge ruled Tuesday that U.S. State Department officials and aides to the wicked bitch, Hillary Clinton, should be questioned under oath about whether the former Secretary of the State's use of private email system was an effort to skirt open record laws. The ruling by U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan is likely to add to the uncertainty hovering over Clinton, the front runner for the Democratic nomination for the November U.S. presidential election, about the legal consequences of her decision to exclusively use private email server in her New York home for her government work. They may get her. I doubt it. But I know it won't be before the election. And, of course, obviously, if she becomes the president, they'll never get her.
Slouching down a march of folly, the threats for outbreak of World War I elicited comparisons between the circumstances of the European crisis that touched off that horrendous conflict and conditions that surround current international conflicts. Military confrontation with Russia and Iran, as ex-CIA analyst Paul R. Piller explains, the centenary in 2000.
Slouching down a march of folly. The threats from Turkey and Saudi Arabia to mount a full-scale invasion of Syria create the potential for a modern-day march of folly into World War III by drawing NATO and the United States into a direct military confrontation with Russia and Iran, as ex-CIA analyst Paul R. Piller explains. The centenary in 2014 of the outbreak of World War I elicited comparisons between the circumstances of the European crisis that touched off that horrendous conflict and conditions that surround current international conflicts. Many such comparisons focused on how confrontations involving an increasingly assertive China might spin out of control. Graham Allison, for example, wrote of how a possible confrontation in the East China Sea involving Japan could carry such a danger. A rising China throwing its increasing weight around the Far East does indeed offer some of the most plausible scenarios for escalation of local crises into much bigger war.
But so does the multifaceted civil war in Syria, as underscored by some of the most recent developments in the northwest of that country. King Salman of Saudi Arabia and his entourage arrived to greet President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama at King Khalid International Airport in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, January 27, 2015. King Salman of Saudi Arabia and his entourage arrived to greet President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama at King Khalid International Airport in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, January 27, 2015. The prospect of the Syrian conflict remaining unsettled for years and thus providing many opportunities for it to grow into something bigger is the starting point for spinning out escalatory scenarios. But some more specific attributes of that conflict have greater and more disturbing similarities to the 1914 crisis. One is the multiplicity of players, from outside as well as inside Syria and the region, who perceive themselves as having a stake in the conflict. That perception is fuel for possible escalation. Atop a recent article describing the diverse players participating in fighting in Syria's Aleppo province, the Washington Post used a headline about a mini-world war there. Related to the perceptions about stakes is the tendency to view the war in Syria as part of a larger conflict between large coalitions. This view amplifies the perceived stakes ever further and also brings into play a sense of obligation to friends and allies. The line UPS relevant to the Syria conflict actually are messy and more complicated than that, but they often have come to be treated as if the line UPS were as well defined as the Entente and the Central Powers at the start of World War I. The outlook involved is readily apparent in the tendency in the United States to see anything that Russia or Iran is doing in Syria as by definition contrary to the United States' interests, whether it actually is or not. The most disturbing correspondence with the situation in Europe a century ago is the active role played by second-order powers that have become obsessed with the local outcome in Syria, are driven partly by internal political neuroses, and are positioned to drag more deeply into the conflict major powers from which they demand support. This description applies to two second-order powers in particular. One is Saudi Arabia. Its policies are being made by the latest claimants to leadership in an archaic family-run enterprise that is trying to throw its own regional weight around and feels obliged to assert forcefully the Sunni cause in sectarian conflicts. The overthrow of Bashar Assad has become an idée fixe for the Saudi regime, at the cost of exacerbation of the conflict in Syria and ignoring or exacerbating the problems of Sunni extremism there. Recently, the Saudis have talked about upping the external involvement in the conflict even more with an insistence that the United States lead the way in doing so. The other player that has become a major problem in Syria is Turkey. A few years ago, Turkey looked like more of a solution than a problem in the Middle East. But that has changed. A formerly promising effort to deal constructively with Turkey's perpetual Kurdish issue has died, and the current top Turkish obsession is to oppose the activities of armed Syrian Kurds, although most of what those fighters have been doing in the Syrian war is favorable as far as the United States' interests are concerned. The megalomania and domestic political frustrations of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan have led to greater Turkish risk-taking, as demonstrated by the shooting down of a Russian warplane that had incidentally strayed for only seconds into Turkish airspace. The potential for Turkey dragging the United States into bigger trouble is made all the greater by its status as a party to the North Atlantic Treaty. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu recently stated, "The only thing we expect from our the United States ally is to support Turkey with no ifs or buts." Assassination of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne lit the match that led to the great conflagration that was World War I. Terrorism also could play a role in escalation of the Syrian mess, and not only because of the major part that ISIS plays in that mess. Instructive in that regard is a recent bombing against a military convoy in Ankara that killed 28 people. Turkish authorities insist that the Syrian Kurdish militia that has been fighting in northwest Syria was responsible, although that militia strongly denies any involvement and a completely separate Kurdish group in Turkey has claimed responsibility. We on the outside are left to guess, but this affair sounds a lot like the Turkish government manipulating attributions of responsibility to try to support its campaign to oppose the Syrian Kurds. The Turkish-Russian line of conflict, which underlay multiple Russo-Turkish wars, across several centuries, could be at the center of escalation and expansion of the Syrian conflict. If so, there would be shades again of World War I, in which the Russian and Ottoman empires were on opposite sides. If the Syrian conflict were to escalate and expand greatly, it would not be because any one player intended that to happen. What happened in 1914 was not intended either. The tragic possibilities would involve lesser steps leading to unforeseen larger results. Nor would catastrophic escalation require us now to foresee and spell out in advance a particular scenario for that happening. Allison wrote in his piece 2 years ago, claims that war is inconceivable are not statements about what is possible in the world, but rather, about what our limited minds can conceive. Perhaps relevant in this regard is that the leader of one of the major players involved, President Vladimir Putin of Russia, has shown himself to be a better short-term tactician than a long-term strategist. A repeat of 1914 and the outbreak of another great war is very unlikely. But it is a risk. Even small risks need to be taken account of in policy making if the risk contingency would be extremely harmful. Remember Dick Cheney's 1% doctrine? The outbreak of another great war would be many times more harmful than somebody's unconventional weapons program. Taking account of this or any other risk should not be the sole consideration as far as policy decisions are concerned. This is one factor among many. In the case of Syria, this risk is an additional reason among other reasons including avoiding lesser harms and curtailing the human suffering from the war to work to de-escalate and defuse rather than to escalate and expand. It is a reason to give high priority to efforts to secure ceasefires and to realize that tamping down this still local war is more important than prosecuting the war to obtain a particular local result.
And that's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back with you on Thursday. And that snow is really piling up out there. How about that? Sayonara.